This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
University of St. Thomas, Jarabek Center at 7 p.m. on Saturday, October 13th. The event is free and open to the public. Journey members will be available to speak out at churches and congregations on Sunday, October 14th. They will also be available to speak at high schools, universities, civic clubs, and other organizations on October 15th and 16th. To schedule a speaker, contact Dave Atwood at 832-693-5710 or dpatwood@igc.org. KPFT, Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Barrett.
And I'm Dwight.
Flicted is on location in Galveston. He'll be calling in. He actually will be calling in a report on the hurricane as it comes ashore in Galveston. Flicked, I don't know what Flicted's deal is. He might actually call in, but he has excused himself from tonight's program to run down to Galveston for the tropical storm.
Don't say hurricane.
Yeah, I don't want to panic anyone.
It's not a hurricane yet.
Although the worst thing that's hit us in a long time was a tropical storm, a tropical depression, so hurricane might actually kind of make people relax a little bit.
Yeah, that last bad tropical storm thing, I remember that because my house got flooded and I had to move.
It's a Tan Crank Radio time.
So, yes, it is.
All right, so we're glad you're here. I'm going to be running the board, so that'll be interesting. It's been a while. I don't get to do this very often, but we do have Barrett will be manning the phones. And we invite you to visit our website, geekradio.com. I should mention that we are going to have a special guest tonight. I don't know if Pete, if you got the email, but at the around 8:30 after the Technology Bites info shot, we're going to have the Psy guy from the Chronicle blogs, his real name being
Eric Berger.
Eric Berger.
Right.
We can has
Eric Berger.
Yes.
Yeah, he'll be on probably hopefully around 8:30, and we'll talk about Tropical Storm Umberto.
We're going to talk about the technology that the secret government technology used to generate Hurricane.
Right.
Right. So get your tinfoil hats. It'll be a good show. So, yeah, we're going to talk to the Psy guy and ask him all the burning questions, like, is he still in mourning over Mr. Wizard and so forth. So we have that to look forward to at the half-hour mark of the program. Visit us online at geekradio.com. Hang out with us in IRC, that's Internet Relay Chat, on irc.cuckoo.com in pound tech bites. If all of that didn't really make much sense to you, but you'd still like to try participating, you can go to the website, click on the link for the live chat, and that'll take you over there. Just pick yourself a nickname. It has instructions on how to change your nickname from anonymous to something you'll know when people are talking to you. The phone number here is 713-526-5738. There's contact information on the website if you want to send us a question or general inquiries about the program or what the heck we think we're doing. You can do that via geekradio.com. Thanks to everyone. I want to thank the Houstonist for the really awesome gallery show at M Squared last Friday. We met a lot of, you know, there's a lot of cross-pollination between the art community and the KPFT community and the Technology Bites community. I have a piece on display there. You can go see it. And it was a great reception, great turnout. And those pieces will be up for another couple of weeks at the M Squared Gallery in the Heights. But the Houstonists did a great job putting that show on, and we're glad to call them our friends. Groovehouse is a contributor for the Houstonists. He's also our phone guy, call screener. So kudos to them. All right, so with that being said, if everything goes well and I can push the right buttons in the right order and make this happen, we'll have the news.
It's the Technology Bites Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Tonight we start with the black screen of death, which actually is a hoax. So that pretty much burns the drama of the story. But there was earlier rumors of a new harsher anti-piracy measure in Windows Vista that was actually believed to be true. Australian PC World printed an email yesterday. It says was sent from a Microsoft representative to an unspecified large Vista OEM distributor. The email describes a new initiative which renders computers running a pirated copy of Vista unusable by making the screen totally black. Ooh. Microsoft was quick to debunk this email warning of a black screen of death. A Microsoft representative told Wired News that, quote, the reporter received inaccurate information and the company has not rolled out any updates to Windows Vista's anti-piracy platform yet. Now, he didn't say that. I'm just trying to increase the tinfoil hat quotient. Vista's software protection platform, SPP, itself the descendant of the Windows Genuine Advantage anti-piracy system used by XP, switches into a mode called Reduced Functionality Mode when the Vista product key fails to authorize properly. While the platform's purpose is to prevent people from running pirated copies of Vista, SPP has encountered criticisms from users citing instances of false positives, as well as privacy concerns stemming from the fact that the system phones home to Microsoft to validate the key. Apparently, when Vista is forced into reduced functionality mode, the start menu and desktop icons disappear, and the desktop background changes to black, so you wonder if that's not where part of it came from. But this leaked email, which according to the original story was sent out last week, talks about a black screen, leading many to assume that Microsoft had stepped up its efforts to thwart Vista pirates. Here's another one this one's a less happy story. I mean, I'm sure you've heard about adventurer Steve Fawcett, who went out in a single engine airplane and disappeared, and they don't, you know, in Nevada. But here's the cool internet angle to the story, you know, at least getting something good out of it. Up to 50,000 people are hunting for missing aviator Steve Fawcett, and they're doing it from at home. It's a distributed search using satellite images and Amazon's Mechanical Turk. That's Amazon's service where usually, this one's free, but where they get people to do small tasks for a small fee. And so it's designed to break up large tasks into these small pieces so that they can, you know, record what happens. And so what's happening is the Army of Volunteers is scrutinizing satellite images that show small chunks of the 17,000-square-mile region where Fawcett's plane is thought to have crashed. It uses satellite images from Digital Globe, which is the company that provides images for Google Earth. The helpers are issued squares that represent a 278-foot square piece of the search area. If they see something that looks worth closer study, participants flag it. Since each square is issued to 10 different people, squares that are flagged by several volunteers are given greater scrutiny. So it's not just, you know, counting on one. One guy, the hardiest participant, is a 25-year-old software designer, Andy Chantrell of Castle Donington, England, who worked on it for 13 straight hours on Monday and says he put in 30 total hours examining about 5,000 squares. So he said he tagged some, but didn't know if they got closer inspection or not. But it helps them narrow it down. Amazon has a policy of not releasing the number of participants in Mechanical Turk projects. But Wired News learned that up to 50,000 people have joined the search since it began on Friday. I'm sure if you go to Amazon, you can find the links to it. And at first, people in the business of, you know, searching for people like that were skeptical. But then when they saw how it breaks down, it actually could be workable. And it would be fascinating if someone in a whole nother... if somebody in an entirely different country happened to find, you know, the evidence that gets him rescued or that finds where the plane went down. The actual on-site searchers have found apparently like six other plane crashes that hadn't been discovered before, but none of them are Mr. Fawcett's plane. And now into other news. Here's another one where there's a story. And then there's the sort of technology twist to the story, and that's what gets it in here. You may have seen, you know, Osama bin Laden has put out apparently two videos lately, and which is the first that he's had out since before the elections in 2004, the presidential elections. A man named Neil Krawitz of Hacker Factor, an expert on digital image forensics, said in his latest blogs that the video contained many visual and audio splices and that all of the modifications were of very low quality. The interesting part is that, you know, there's, if you've seen the video, bin Laden's beard looks it's very black, where in the earlier videos from some years ago, it had gray in it. As far as Neil Krawitz's tools can detect, there's been no image manipulation of the bin Laden portion of the image beyond contrast adjustment, and that his beard really does appear to be that color. The interesting part, though, is that here's some of the stuff this guy has found out. He says the inner frame of bin Laden was resaved at least twice and not at the same time. The images show fine horizontal stripes on bin Laden and a background indicating these came from interlaced video sources. In contrast, the text elements, such as the As-Sahab logo, appear to be from non-interlaced sources. The September 7th video shows bin Laden dressed in a white hat, white shirt, and yellow sweater. Krawitz notes that this is the same clothing he wore in the 2004 October 29th video. In 2004, he had it unzipped, but in 2007, the bottom half is zipped up. The 2007 release. Besides the clothing, it appears to be the same background, same lighting, and same desk. Even the camera angle is almost identical. Krawitz also notes that if you overlay the 2007 video with the 2004 video, his face has not changed in 3 years, only his beard is darker, and the contrast on the picture has been adjusted. So that's interesting. But the big important thing is the edits. At roughly a minute and a half into the video, there's a splice. Bin Laden shifts from looking at the camera to looking down in less than 1/25th of a second, which means there's something was cut out. And at 13 minutes and 13 seconds, there's a second less obvious splice. In all, Krawitz says there are at least six splices in the video. Of these, there are only two live Bin Laden segments. The rest of the video is composed of still images. The first live section opens the video and ends at a minute 56. The second section begins at 12:29 and continues until 14:01. The two live sections appear to be from different recordings because the desk is closer to the camera in the second section. You know, one of those splices, and you have to be fairly sharp to notice that. Then there's the audio edits. Apparently, on the audio part, there are so many splices that Mr. Krawitz cannot help but wonder if someone spliced words and phrases together. He also cannot rule out a vocal imitator during the frozen frame audio. The only way to prove the audio is really bin Laden is to see him talking in the video. Another bin Laden video was released on September 11th, yesterday, and was much more straightforward. There was a still image of the black-bearded bin Laden, oddly using a frame not used in the previous video, and then they went over to a long, unedited video of a statement read by the American-born Azam al-Amriki. So it's just interesting to see the thing, the part, I guess one of the things that's most interesting to me is that in looking at the news, I haven't seen a lot of talk about the fact that one of the things that Neil Krawitz says is all the information that is current, all the stuff that talks about current events in this video, happens during the still portion when you can't see his mouth moving. So that was just very interesting. And it's pretty cool to see somebody who can get into some real analysis of it and share it with the rest of us, because it lets lets more of us know what the heck is going on with some of that. Now on other news, the previously mandated analog TV cutoff date of 2009 has been extended by the FCC, meaning that even though broadcasters like NBC, who send out the shows, will be dropping the analog feed, cable operators will still have to support analog TV sets. They have two ways to do it. They can either convert digital SD signals to analog SD signals and throw it across their cable lines to you, or they can give all their, this is in Gizmodo, they can give all their grandma and grandpa customers with old sets a digital to analog converter box. It's a trade-off between sucking up more of their bandwidth or giving away free equipment. Come 2012, 5 years from now, the FCC will make another decision whether to force cable operators to support analog signals. Although if you've got just over-the-air TV is what you get, then I think you're out of luck in 2009. And another place where you may be out of luck is when Apple releases iPhone firmware updates, if you have an iPhone, and maybe you've hacked it to software unlock the phone. If you update it, it may re-lock the phone. Apparently, all software unlocks are vulnerable to Apple's firmware updates, according to the iPhone dev team. Apparently, unless you steal the RSA key, which is a top-secret thing and highly improbable, Apple can re-lock all the unlocks with their next firmware update. This could be the person who, on the iPhone dev team, said this could be like the PSP's firmware, and the war could continue until one of the two parties give up. In other news, though, Apple is taking a position of neutrality on the various extensions to the iPhone. So there's that. And now, a Technology Bytes public service. Technology Bytes, along with Microsoft, want to help college students steal Microsoft Office. Now, steals in quotes, you probably couldn't hear that in my voice, but no, for college students who want Office 2007 but don't want to pay the nearly $700 that Microsoft wants for it, the software maker is offering another option to steal it in their promotion called Ultimate Steal. College students can get the ultra-high-end Ultimate Edition of Office for just $60. The promotion runs through April 30th and started today. It launches next week in France, Italy, and Spain, in case, I don't know, if Barrett enrolls in college and goes back to Ibiza. To be eligible, Microsoft said students have to be actively enrolled in a higher education program and have an email address from that school. So, of course, this is their way, part of it is, if they get you into using it now for cheap, they hope to be able to sell you the, I don't know, Windows. Let's see, this is Office 2007. They're looking to sell you Office 2012 Insano Ultimate Idiocracy Edition for, only $15,000. So they're hooking you early, like any dealer. The early ones are cheap. And in better news, that's good news, though, to save that money. If you need Office and you want to use it, saving, 90% of the cost is probably not a bad thing. Let's see, on other news, yes, it's Apple iPod-y stuff. The tests are in on battery life, and Apple had pretty good battery life claims for the iPod Nano and the iPod Classic. The iPod Nano, Apple said, would go for 24 hours of continuous audio and 5 hours of video. When iLounge tested it, they got over 30 hours of audio, and they got almost 6 hours of video, which out of something as small as the iPod Nano is pretty amazing. The big king, though, is the Apple 160-gig iPod Classic. Apparently the 80 and the 60 do different amounts of time that they last. The iPod Classic played videos for 9 hours and 28 minutes before expiring on a battery charge. 9 hours and 28 minutes. That means you could bring, you know, with 160-gig, you could bring a lot of movies, and you could fly almost all the way to, oh, I don't know, the UK from Houston and watch videos the entire way on your iPod and not run out of juice, or be at least most of the flight. The audio test goes even more, it's even more incredible. The audio lasted 56 hours on one charge. So if you're going to be like, I don't know, circumnavigating the globe in an airplane, then maybe you want the iPod 160-gig Classic. The thing is, I don't think that you won't have listened to all the music that the 160 gigs holds before you run out of batteries. So anyways, thought that one was interesting. And now a few quick hits on new products. Microsoft, this one was interesting. They have the new Mobile Memory Mouse 8000. What a long name, huh? It packs 1 gigabyte of flash memory for secret files. This is out of Gizmodo, so it says, to quote them, it packs 1 gig of flash memory for secret files, porn, your wife's pictures, porn, and even the occasional Excel spreadsheet cataloging your porn. Running off 2.4 gigahertz or Bluetooth, the mouse is adjustable with the flick of a switch. And while the idea of storage in a mouse may feel like Microsoft is just adding the proverbial clock, it allows users to operate a mobile mouse without losing a USB port for storage when a recharge is needed. So it's for efficiency. It's about $100, and it's going to come out in October. But, you know, for with a laptop, that's not a bad thing to be able to store a gig of stuff. And then you can, I don't know, go use the mouse with a desktop somewhere and have your porn or your files with you. Now for extreme computing, two extreme stories. Just in case those, you know, terabyte drives that other companies are offering are just not enough for your data storage needs, LaCie released some big disks today, one called the Too Big, number two, the word big, dual, one called the Too Big Triple, and the last is called the Too Big Network. They all look about the same. They have different connectivity on the back. But the whole deal is the small one is 1 terabyte, and they go up to 2 terabytes of data for $939. So, you know, yeah, you can have your 160-gig iPod, but for an additional $600 or $700, you can have 2 terabytes of video, which I think you could probably put every movie you've ever watched from DVD onto that 2 terabytes. That is a hellacious amount of space. And speaking of hellacious, NASA has developed some incredible computer processors. They don't want heat sinks, mods, and water-cooled contraptions. NASA's new CPU can go 1,700 hours of uninterrupted processing at the low, low temperature of 500 degrees Celsius. Now, just for those of you who don't know how to convert Fahrenheit to Celsius, I'm not going to convert this. You can go to use a calculator. But the deal is 500 degrees Celsius is a lot more in Fahrenheit. 100 degrees Celsius is 212 degrees, you know, so you boil water at 100 degrees Celsius. So it's 5 times the temperature of boiling water. You can use this processor for 1,700 hours. Scientists at the space agency have developed a chip which they call the silicon carbide differential amplifier integrated circuit, which doesn't spell anything if you use the first letters, unlike NASA. Taking the approach of using more heat-resistant materials rather than external and extraneous cooling technology. Quote, this new capability can eliminate the additional plumbing, wires, weight, and other performance penalties required to liquid-cool traditional sensors and electronics, says Phil Noydick, a NASA electrical engineer, adding, it's really a significant step toward mission-enabling harsh environmental and electronics. Also, they believe that this is the first step towards our robotic overlords that can withstand extreme conditions in the war against humanity. The agency believes that the new technology will lead to improvements in safety and fuel efficiency, as well as reduced jet engine emissions, though team leaders say they're mainly hoping to, quote, seriously jack up our wow rigs, according to Engadget. And that's the news.
All right. Thanks for the news.
They didn't say anything about extreme tropical storm performance of the processor, though, so I just wondered.
Oh, yeah, like how it would do at floodwaters or high winds.
Yeah, down on Galveston Bay with Flicted in a rowboat.
Good old Flicted.
Man, that's what I hope he does call in.
Hopefully he welded some pontoons onto the Harley or onto the Yamaha or Honda. I'm going to be in trouble over that. Honda, right?
I think it's going to be the Honda.
Okay.
It's a Honda motorcycle and a Honda. Is it a Honda? It is a Honda motorcycle.
Yeah.
And but I don't think he took the motorcycle down.
I don't know. To increase the survivability, he probably took his pickup. That's my guess. The tough one.
Yeah, take the vintage pickup truck. They can just load it up with storm debris.
Which has questionable brakes anyway, so.
Well, here's hoping that he, that he's okay. You know, I mean, it's not like the biggest storm. It's not like he's going down there during, you know, Katrina or something. But he is putting his life at risk, not for the show. Not really for reasons understood by anyone here. That's what he's doing. All right. Well, we are going to take a guest here before we take calls. But do we have the guest?
Well, it looks like this.
We may.
May on line five. Someone has called in. So.
Oh, on line five.
So I did the news a little too early.
Well, we told him to call in around 8:20. But he might have been using...
Yeah, there he is.
Might have been using some kind of scientific watch.
He does have a very cool binary watch that... I don't know if he's wearing that today, but...
Actually, he predicted that there was a 60% chance of him calling in.
Yeah, well, there's a chance that his call will make landfall here at the radio station. So go ahead and let's see if we can get him on the air. Eric?
Hello, how are you guys?
Good. Mr. Berger, how are you, Mr. Sci Guy?
I'm doing just fine tonight.
Well, we're glad to have you on the show tonight. It was very kind of you to agree to do this. For our listeners at home, Eric Berger is the Sci Guy for the Houston Chronicle. He blogs the Sci Guy. It says blogs.cron.com/SCIGUI. Sci Guy rhymes with Bill Nye. Are you friends with Bill?
I'm not friends with Bill, but, you know, when I was younger, I certainly appreciated his work.
You know, friends of Bill has another connotation. So.
Friends of Nye.
All right. And, so Dwight had this idea that you would come on the show tonight and talk to us about the science of hurricanes and tropical storms and so forth.
Well,
and,
you know, really, I wanted to come on and just sort of sing the praises of computers.
Okay.
Because without computers, the hurricane forecasters would be completely blind.
Oh, we're not talking about forecasting. I thought we were talking about generating hurricanes.
Oh, my questions are not going to work now.
Aren't you tied into like the government labs that generate weather?
Well, the government certainly has tried a lot of times over the last 30 years to control weather, but they haven't had any success.
That we know of.
Yeah, sure. Uh-huh. Yeah. Right.
So you've been silenced, have you?
They got to me.
Well, I actually wouldn't mind talking a little bit about the science of controlling weather perhaps later on, but so you were saying you think that computers are a great thing and have revolutionized weather forecasting?
Well, let's go back to the 1980s, back when, you know, you maybe had an Apple IIgs or something sitting on your desktop. And I don't know much about supercomputers back then, but I don't think they were all that super. If you had a hurricane out in the middle of the Gulf, about 500 miles away, 2 days out. So today, the forecast there would be about 100 miles either way, pretty good. Back in the 80s, before there were really good supercomputer models, the approximate cone of uncertainty for that hurricane making landfall, if Houston were like their best guess, would be from Brownsville to New Orleans. And of course, 2 days before landfall is way too late to call for an evacuation, so you can imagine if you were an emergency planner back then trying to sort of get people out of harm's way. So that was the 80s. And today, the forecasts are just, you know, much, much, much better. A two-day forecast back then is about as accurate as a 5 or 6 day forecast today. And so that starts to give emergency planners some some ability to sort of predict and call for evacuations, and almost all of that is due to computers. In fact, in 2005, the so-called Super Ensemble, which is actually sort of an ensemble of several computer models, was better by a few miles than the actual National Hurricane Center forecast track on average for storms that year.
So with all these computers, why did we suddenly get taken by surprise by Umberto?
Because the computers, you know, aren't very good either. I mean,
they can't see into the future.
Was it the blue screen of death for our computer model?
It was the butterfly flapping its wings across, you know, halfway around the world and creating sort of the chaos. I mean, weather is chaotic. And so, you know, you're trying to predict the future, and you start with an initial set of conditions, and if you sort of iterate that forward, you know, 24, 48 hours, you know, hundreds of meteorological variables, you're bound to have an error to creep in.
So basically, it's easier to predict where a hurricane's going if you actually have a hurricane.
That's right. That's
so, right. Or tropical storm. I don't want to alarm anyone. It's not a hurricane. But, yeah, certainly if modeling general weather conditions for the possibility of a hurricane coming up out of this batch of clouds or this cold front or this, you know, southerly wind blowing up the coast or whatever, that's not quite there yet.
Well, computer models are based on mathematics and physics, and they don't have all the physics of hurricane genesis down yet. So you're sort of making a lot of assumptions.
We make a lot of assumptions with the season. At least we know what time of year they're likely to come around. They don't tend to go out much beyond the so-called hurricane season.
That's right. Now, well, they do sometimes, but you're right. I mean, we know sort of the basic conditions under which hurricanes form. You have to have sea surface temperature has to be about 80 degrees Fahrenheit or 28 Celsius, and you know, there has to be relatively low wind shear, and there has to be a low pressure center. And if you have those conditions, then it's generally, they're called favorable conditions for hurricane formation. But oftentimes, storms don't develop for, you know, reasons that aren't entirely clear.
So how did this one come about so suddenly? What exactly happened?
Well, the Hurricane Center had been watching it for a number of days because it was a center of low pressure, and there were thunderstorms associated with it. It was just sort of elongated, which means it was sort of stretched out in a long line rather than sort of circling around a point like you are familiar with.
And we had a cold front come through, right, yesterday?
We had a cool front. That sort of stalled over the Houston area.
We had a frontal system come from the north.
Right. If you live in Clear Lake like me, you didn't get any of it. And if you live up in Conroe, you probably had some slightly lower temperatures and drier air. But that really didn't affect the system.
That didn't contribute.
No, I mean, it was over warm Gulf water, and it was sort of a question of, well, will the system get its act together before it comes ashore? And, you know, for days and days, the Hurricane Center and sort of other forecasters saying, well, you know, the odds of this organizing, the odds are against it. Well, the system beat the odds, and last night, while we were all sleeping, it sort of got its act together, and this morning it just sort of kept strengthening. And, you know, frankly, we're all pretty lucky that it's about to come ashore, because if it had been a few hundred miles further out, we'd probably be looking at a Category 1 or 2 or maybe even 3 hurricane coming on land tomorrow. So
if I'm not a meteorologist and
but he plays one on the radio.
But I play one on the radio, and I know how to click the maps that make then
I play one on the internet.
Right, I play one on the internet. I can click those maps and make the map move, you know, and the spin and the motion that I'm seeing looks like it may take this so that the dirty side of it is east of the Houston area. Is that the way it's looking to you?
Well, you know, you could really say that if you're talking about a hurricane.
Uh-huh.
You know, in a hurricane, the track is really important because the winds are strongest at the center. In a hurricane, you're concerned about winds and, you know, you're concerned about the dirty side because that's the right side of the storm. But with tropical storms, you could really throw a lot of that out because the whole thing is dirty. And
right, because it's all pretty much not as well organized as like a hurricane.
That's exactly right. And it's, you know, whoever gets stuck under the thunderstorms that train or sort of come in right after one another is the one who's really going to get pounded. So most of the area probably gets a few inches of rain, and some unlucky areas really get hammered.
Well, I think that was what was most surprising or kind of caught everybody off guard with Allison is, you know, it wasn't like a hurricane coming, you know, barreling down on you. It was organized and you knew what to expect. It just formed off the Gulf, and it stalled. It just sat on top of us and generated rain in random tropical storm way that it did, and drowned everybody.
Yeah, Allison was certainly an interesting thing. You talk to some sort of, you know, weather geeks about Allison, and they'll say, well, the Hurricane Center just named that Allison because they wanted to get people's attention. It was never even a tropical storm, because it really wasn't. I mean, it was just sort of an area of low pressure that sort of, you know, moved inland and just parked itself over Houston and sort of went back and north and south a little bit, but just sort of like a conveyor belt brought that warm, moist air off the Gulf, and, you know.
Well, for lack of a better term, the cold front, is that playing to our advantage, or is that a potential problem as this warm tropical storm meets the cooler air? Is it just going?
Well, I'm not a meteorologist either, but I'll play one on the radio. And it's probably going to make things a little bit worse because that frontal system is colliding with the tropical storm and sort of creating atmospheric instability. So that sort of enhances a little bit the chances of showers. Now, what actually may save us in a day or two is another frontal system that's not as strong as they thought earlier in the week is going to sort of come down from the north. And the hope is that this will sort of meet somewhere north of Houston and spin the system out to the northeast rather than sort of it stopping and you know, raining on us for 4 or 5 days like Alex did.
Go ahead, Barrett.
I've got a question. I was wondering what kind of productivity tools these storms are using to get organized. I guess they'd have to be mobile apps.
Clearly, it's a Microsoft suite of tools.
Path of destruction in their wake. Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't know.
Actually.
I think they've been switching to Apple's iStorm tools. So,
well, the storm has an I. If Apple were to brand hurricanes, it would just be the Apple I. They should actually. Apple computers should sponsor like hurricane reports, and it could be the Apple I of the storm is located and give the latitude and longitude.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
I think Steve Jobs would look great in his black turtleneck in front of one of those green screens,
because,
you know, showing the...
Because getting hit by a hurricane is not nearly as bad as finding out that the iPod you just bought dropped by 200.
Or if you took your iPod out in a storm and got a couple drops of rain on it.
And that's it.
So, well, as a weather geek, are there sites besides, you know, the usual, like, weather.com that you use to kind of get more information or deeper information about this kind of stuff?
I really just kind of, you know, pull it out of my... No, you know, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of resources on the web for...
Well, what I think what he's looking for is, like, do you know of a specific resource that might actually have better information or give you a... my experience has been, like, when you look at... You know, obviously the local weather is very much about, oh my God, we're going to, you know, disaster, because they're playing up the hype and they're trying to get viewers. If you go to weather.com or you go to the, you know, it's more vague. It doesn't seem to be as crisis oriented. And then if you go all the way out to like NOAA, the NOAA weather site, it's right. Kind of dry in terms of the information, and it's hard, but... So where in there do you fall?
The point number one would be stay away from AccuWeather, because they're going to hype up every storm. And like this morning, their lead forecast was talking about how Humberto, which hadn't been named yet, was going to bring rains to Houston worse than Allison. Sort of, but this is one case where the government actually provides the best information by far. And when it comes to hurricane forecasting and providing satellite information and providing real-time data from all the satellites that are up there sort of watching the planet, it's amazing the amount of information that is out there on government websites, on university websites that sort of repackage the government data and present it for free in near real time. I mean, there's just a wealth of resources of publicly available data. And then there are some good sites like Weather Underground that has a guy named Jeff Masters who's very, very good when it comes to hurricanes and explaining it. And sort of where I see myself is sort of someone who, I'm not a meteorologist, but I've, you know, read a lot and written a lot about hurricanes, so I sort of can look at the government data and sort of look at the official forecast and sort of try to explain sort of the reasoning behind what forecasters think is going to happen and sort of, you know, sort of answer some of the questions as a coastal homeowner that I know other people have for the Houston area.
Is there anything for the, I guess, the weather geek or the aspiring weather geek? Is there a software program or something like that that you can run on a desktop that maybe does some very low-level modeling, or you can input data into that is available from these sites, like, you know, like a do-it-yourself, like the SETI program?
Well, I know that the raw data from some of the major American models is put on the web, so you could sort of run that or package that data in sort of almost any way you want. But some of the universities, like Florida State, for example, sort of puts all of these models out in sort of a user format that just sort of, you know, presents it. And so the data, the raw data is out there for people who want to interpret it, you know, on different government websites.
Okay, just so that somebody might want to, you know, play their own hand at predicting where a hurricane might go. Or, I mean, obviously, you know, the level of computing that it takes to really do these models with any accuracy. I have seen some sites, I don't know the name of one right off the top of my head right now, but I have seen the sites that let you, they show you past hurricanes where you can watch the track and it shows you, like, in, you know, gives you a timeline and shows you how the hurricane traveled, and then it shows you what the predicted track is for the current hurricanes that are, you know, in process of happening.
Right, yeah, sort of storms that pass through this sort of area at this time of year, where did they go?
Right.
And that's basically was the origin of the first so-called computer models that we were talking about, that sort of these climatological-based models that said, you know, what did storms here go in the past at this time of year? And so there's a funny story about that. That particular model is called the Clipper 5 model, and this was back when we were a little bit concerned about Dean, but sort of, I had sort of for a day and a half said, look, it's not going to hit Texas, it's going to go in, you know, it's going to go into Mexico, you know, the United States is not going to be affected by this. You still had the Lieutenant Governor of Texas talking about sort of maintaining vigilance and, you know, quotes in the, you know, on Fox News and in the San Antonio papers about how we must, you know, we need to keep our eye on the system because two of the models still bring it into South Texas. Well, one of the models is this climatological model from 25 years ago that the Hurricane Center tests all of its new models against. And if they can't beat it, the new model's thrown out because the Clipper 5 is just, you know, not really a model. And the second model that was bringing the storm into Texas was worse than the Clipper 5 model in 2005, the 2005 hurricane season. So you got to be careful when you're going on the web sort of looking at it, because there is so much information, it's pretty easy to misinterpret it.
So I understand that Dwight was telling me that the right now your stuff is burning up the blog server at the Cron.
Yeah, Dwight, I think, told me I melted the blog server.
We were linking to the Hurricane Archive in his blog that is quite long, quite extensive. Every time we've had some kind of major tropical event or there's a hurricane, he blogs in it. He posts maps and images and so forth. And so there's large image files, and it was really long. And so every time, and so we had thousands of people today, because they were interested in it, calling this up because it was the main link off our main website. And the systems people called and said, please, please, point it at something else. So we created an Umberto category, and that's what we're pointing to now. But yeah, they actually used the phrase "he's melting the blog server," which made us all proud.
Yeah, indeed.
So the tropical storm will do relatively little to no damage, but the Chronicles servers will just go up as a result of the hurricane. So it actually will have had an effect.
That's right.
Limited.
That's right. The Umberto effect.
How you've coined a new term for for blog burning. Like when I got, you know, like when you get slash dotted or you get a link to your ketchup fiasco on Boing Boing.
That's right.
Well, you know, is there anything else you'd like to cover? Let's just talk for just a second, you know, a few minutes here maybe about weather control. Okay. Is that even in the realm of possibility?
Well, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, the government had a project called Project Storm Fury, where they were actually trying to seed clouds to make them rain. And it was actually with the idea of sort of trying to dissipate hurricanes. You'd go over and you'd drop silver iodide into the clouds. It would stimulate the formation of precipitation. And the energy, which in hurricanes is carried by the water and the water vapor, it would rain out, and it would sort of weaken before it got to landfall. And it just, they tried it and it just didn't work. And there have been other attempts at weather modification. Actually, next summer we're going to get a pretty good look at whether or not this really works, because the Chinese have been trying all kinds of different things to get the with the soot and the other particulates out of their air for the Beijing Olympics in 2008. And among the other things, one of the things they're trying to do is sort of stimulate rain so that they can knock some of these soot particles out of the air before the Olympics begin, because otherwise you're going to go over and have, you know, Olympics in a city that's going to look a lot worse than even Los Angeles.
Wow. What about nuke in a hurricane?
See, that's the best question, because you get asked that all the time. I've done a couple stories on sort of trying to control hurricanes through action, and people always ask, why don't you nuke a hurricane? And you get the same question when you write about the space shuttle and the foam falling off the external tank. Well, just put some chicken wire around the external tank. That'll solve the problem for the foam falling off. A hurricane would sort of look at a nuke and laugh, because like a big hurricane puts out as much energy as 20 large nuclear bombs every hour. So, I mean, it's like...
So we drop 40 of them in 30 minutes.
Well, you could drop 40 of them in 30 minutes, and you'd have a very efficient means of spreading...
A lot of radiation.
population. So it's probably not the best idea. I mean, there's all kinds of crazy ideas, like taking out ships that are burning this sort of hot pitch that would sort of disrupt the organization, or trying to churn up cool water in the storm's path from the lower depths. I mean, it's just, these are all sort of massive engineering projects that would require lots of funding, and it's just, it's not an easy thing. I mean, these are huge, huge systems that you know, just can't really be stopped by sort of current
engineering. It is my perception, and I don't know if this holds true for anyone else, but my perception, for the longest time, it seemed that hurricanes were kind of just a given, you know, especially for Florida. You know, it's like, well, Florida got hit, you know, Andrew, whatever, it's Florida, it's going to happen. But then with these recent two hurricanes, Katrina and the other one,
Rita,
there seems to be a lot more, you know, at least outside of Florida, a lot more concern about hurricanes.
Yeah, well, Florida does get struck the most because it sort of sticks out in the Atlantic like a lightning rod. But, you know, historically, the number two state in hurricane strikes has been Texas.
But do you think that, I mean, does it seem to you at all that, I mean, because of these last two hurricanes, these two big ones, that we seem to be somewhat more hurricane conscious?
Absolutely. I mean, it's really sort of been the Katrina effect that sort of brought everyone's attention to it. And the year before, I mean, you know, Florida did get struck by four major hurricanes in 2004. So that sort of started raising eyebrows, and then sort of everyone saw what Katrina did to New Orleans, and everyone freaked. And probably rightly so. And now we've had two more major hurricanes this year, Category 5, that fortunately haven't come near the United States, but that sort of kept the issue in the public mind.
Isn't it scary, I mean, thinking about, you know, when you have a hurricane out in the Gulf and it's threatening landfall somewhere, and everybody is wishing it just somewhere else?
That's right, yeah.
And there's, you know, there's only so many, you know, not so densely populated areas along the coast. I mean, you're basically just wishing it would hit somebody else and wishing all that bad energy just elsewhere.
Well, try writing that in a blog where you're like, well, this is going to hit this, you know, fortunately this isn't going to hit Texas, but
yeah,
definitely someone else is going to get it. No, I mean, the only good area to bring a storm in on the U.S. Gulf Coast is the King Ranch. And there was a, in 1999, a Category 4 Hurricane Brett came in there and, you know, upended a few cows, and that was it. I mean, that's the perfect place to bring hurricanes. So, you know, when we ever figure out how to steer these...
Steer them, yeah.
We're sending them.
Steer them towards the cows.
That's right.
All right, well, I don't want to, you know, take up too much of your time, but we really do appreciate you being on the show with us tonight. And if anybody else has any questions, Dwight, did you want to close it out with them? Or?
I think that'll do it. Eric, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I know you're probably on deadline for the print edition.
No, I'm on deadline for playing Spill the Beans with my 3-year-old daughter.
Aw. Well, go play.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. I enjoyed it.
All right. Well, thanks for being here tonight.
All right. Bye.
All right. That was Eric Berger, the Sci Guy from the Houston Chronicle. You can check him out at blogs.cron.com/SCIGUY. Sci Guy. It's a very popular blog. Lots of science in there. Very interesting read, and
a good community too. He's got a bunch of good commenters, many of whom are scientists themselves.
Scienticians.
Scienticians, right.
All right.
Science.
So We're going to now go back into the regular Technology Bites program. The phone number here is 713-526-5738 if you'd like to be on the air with us this evening. I have no idea. We have calls in the queue.
Yeah, we've got a couple of long-term holders. And we've got a storm chaser that's calling in, too, somewhere south of us.
Oh, well, let's talk to the storm chaser real quick. I'm sorry about the long-term holders, but we're going to stay with the hurt. This is Flicted, our on-the-spot reporter. Flicted?
Yes.
This is your Flicted, this is your Dan Rather moment, dude.
So
I am on the track of Umberto 2007 Galveston Freeport, and just as a public service announcement, if you think about, you know, heading down to the beach, now's a good time to do it. If you're coming from Freeport, because they closed down the toll bridge, you don't have to pay. There's nobody there.
Long as you didn't have to lower it yourself, I guess that's cool.
Get out and crank.
So what has driven...
Might have to drive through some water, though.
What has driven you to go to Galveston when a tropical storm is coming ashore? The Honda?
I was really disappointed when Rita kept going off to the east, you know, because I planned to go down to the coast for it.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in Central Texas, so... I didn't really have any experience with these, you know, water-based storms. So I just kind of want to experience it.
How is it? Do you feel the energy? Is there, like, good wind kicking up?
No, it's not too exciting.
It's kind of lame, huh?
You know, I mean, the wind's blowing. You know, there's rain. The waves were definitely kicked up, you know, near on, you know, to the bottom of the seawall, perhaps. But really, you know, there's really not too much of excitement going on.
Well,
fortunately, depending on if you own a house down there.
Wow. Well, I'm disappointed that you're not here, but I'm happy to hear it's not as exciting as you thought it'd be, so take that.
That just means I have to come down another time.
Yeah.
Or you could move on to your other thrills that you aren't sure you want to experience, like, I don't know, rattlesnake handling or...
Yeah, I didn't grow up with a lot of landmines as a kid. I always wanted to kind of travel to where they had a lot of, you know, live landmines. One day.
Cobras.
So anyway, yeah, unfortunately, you know, nothing too exciting to report. I think everything looks like pretty much, you know, it's going to be okay. Oh, yeah. The only thing, there was a casualty of my brand new shoes. You know, it was the first day I was wearing my shoes, and now they got soaked.
All right. Well, we appreciate you calling in with that exciting and titillating report of the tropical storm Umberto as it comes
Umberto
ashore.
2007.
Well, keep chasing the eye of the storm.
Actually, that's what I'm doing. I'm actually on my way back up 45 right now, trying to find where Umberto currently is located.
Well, if you find it, don't, you know, send it somewhere else.
Send it home.
All right. Well, that's Flicted calling in live from his car heading somewhere north or south on 45 or one of the other highways leading to
and from. And illustrate the difference for you from Technology Bites reporting versus the breathless reports you can get on local television.
Jack it up. Yeah. After our headphones.
Uh-oh.
For our other guest.
We have another guest.
Our call because they've been holding for so long. He just showed up, so he has to wait. But I get him some headphones so he can listen. At least know what's going on because we got...
All right. By you length know, of hold.
You know, if Flicted had been here, that wouldn't have had to happen.
No.
But, right. All right.
Length of hold, we've got Richard.
Richard, you're on the air.
Well, at least you didn't name a hurricane after me.
Well, the night's young.
I have a C drive that is in trouble, but not terminal quite yet. 5-year-old Gateway with XP Home in it. And a couple of years ago, I threw in another D drive to take care of my data files. The current C drive is getting rather noisy with a lot of seek noise. And the startup time is probably increased by a factor of 4. So I think it's time to replace that thing. Is there, in replacing it, is there anything I should be able to do to utilize the fact that I've got a D drive in there?
When you talk about the seek times and the slow boot ups on the drive, the mechanical performance of a hard drive doesn't generally tend to slow down. It generally tends to be the nature of the software installed on the drive itself that's going to be giving you those problems. I mean, it's certainly not going to talk you out of swapping out hard drives. You know, once in a while, maybe that's a good idea to do. But the reality is that you could probably take, you know, your data that you care about, back it up, and then just reload your operating system on that drive and probably see a huge increase in performance.
Yeah, well, I can correlate. The more noise I hear, the longer the startup time.
Well, that's because the drive is having to access, you know, if the drive is severely fragmented, or if you have a lot of things loading up when the system starts up, then that drive's going to be accessing like crazy, and of course that's going to slow down the boot time on the system. But it's not because necessarily that the drive itself is malfunctioning.
Okay.
It's that the software, you know, as you, do you know what, when I use the term defrag, does that mean anything?
Oh, yeah, I've defragged it about 2 weeks ago.
Okay. When the drive is making that noise, it means that the read heads are accessing the platters or the disks on the drive to collect the software that it needs to load up and run, that it's being told to run. That's the operating system,
mm-hmm.
and that's any other background applications like your antivirus security software, updaters for Yahoo, whatever, your instant message clients, all of that stuff is going to cause that drive to access, along with spyware and malicious software. It could be a symptom of that. If you want to determine, I mean, if you're going to take that drive out and replace it anyway, you're going to be doing the same thing, but certainly you don't have to do it twice. You could replace the drive and reload everything on a new drive, but I would say that it might be worth your effort, you know, worth your time to try. How old is the drive itself?
It's a 5-year-old system, and if I reloaded, I got the reload disk here, it would be XP home, and of course I'd have to, you know, bring in service pack 2 and all that good stuff.
So if you get a new drive, what are you going to do?
That was another part of the question. Should I reload that one, or should I, in fact, if you put a new drive in, does that, you know, put you in the category of like an OEM, like you're building your own system and you can get the cheap Vista?
Well, you can certainly buy I don't know if you can buy,
I don't know if I want to put Vista on a 5-year-old box, though.
No, okay. Not at all.
Even with the new drive.
Yeah.
And you can buy the OEM version of Vista without being a system builder now, or without having to buy hardware. What it means ultimately is that you don't get any tech support from Microsoft, that you're essentially your own tech support.
Right.
Okay.
You can go online and find OEM versions of Vista or XP and all that stuff, no problem.
But you don't want to put it on that machine.
No.
Okay, so I guess best first step is just to wipe a lot of the stuff off and reload and see whether.
Well, yeah, that's what I would consider doing. If you're looking to preserve this system, and if you're looking to, if you do want to move to a Vista situation, then I would be, you know, I would encourage you to look at, you know, getting a new computer. A 5-year-old system is still a very capable computer, but certainly the advances in the computing technology over the last 5 years, what you can get, you know, the least expensive computer, modern computer you could buy today, for, you know, anywhere from like $250 to $450 is going to literally run circles around that computer. So if you're looking at just taking this computer, buying a new hard drive, buying a copy of Vista or whatever operating system and trying to get it up and running, you're going to spend most of the money it would take to just replace the PC anyway. So what I would encourage you to consider doing is just back up your data, reload from the restore disks onto that drive, and I think if you haven't reloaded your system in 5 years, you're going to see such a dramatic increase in performance that it's going to be a lot like just having a new PC. That what you're experiencing is normal degradation over time of the install of software on the computer, not necessarily a hardware malfunction.
Okay, let me ask you one other thing with regards kind of on the reload. One thing that happened yesterday was on this old system, there's something called a Music Match Jukebox.
Yeah.
And that thing basically got totally corrupted. It wouldn't work. So I took the program out and reloaded it. And when I did so, it came back and said, well, it's all in there, but you need to sign in as a network administrator because you don't have enough rights. So I opened it up in safe mode and found that now that it has two categories, one my name and the other one administrator. So
right.
I was wondering why it got reloaded in off of the regular utility disks as the administrator level.
I'm not sure I understand the question. All computers, you know, they allow you to have different user accounts, have different access levels to the computer, administrator being the most most privileged account. XP Home on the basic user, the initial user that you log in as, should have administrative rights on the computer. But, Dwight, on XP Home, when you first do a setup on that, the basic user, is it full administrator on XP Home?
Yes, if just as the default, that doesn't mean the account he's using is.
Right.
But the default, when it's set up, is usually one user, and that's an administrator. To see a second...
And XP Home, the administrator account itself is only accessible in the safe mode, is that right?
You first see it in the site. You can surface it, but it is you can access it in safe mode.
Yeah, I've seen it before where you could be logged in as an administrator and then try to install a program and have it tell you that you're not the administrator and it won't let you do it. But, you know, as you indicated, you were having some problems. You had some other corruptions when you tried to remove it. I don't know if I'd want to spin my wheels on it trying to chase that down. I'd be looking at, you know, going ahead and doing a system reload.
All right. I think tomorrow's system reload day.
All right. Well, have a good time with that.
It's a fun time always. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call. All right. Well, I want to get the other long holder before we go to Barrett time. And so we have another one that was pretty late.
Yeah,
holder.
That's going to be Dave.
Dave, you're on the air. Hey.
How you doing?
Good.
An update from last week on my Palm Pilot.
I don't know if I want to hear about the Palm Pilot anymore. You know, it's like there's been nothing we've been able to do in the last...
No, you helped me out. You helped.
We did.
Yes, I turned around and looked on the website, and it had an area that you can get to, and it helped me out, and it's working.
It's working. So
yes.
You're calling in just to report that you actually did finally get the Palm Pilot to work.
No, I got, you know, that was one, but my problem here now is I've got...
You're killing me.
The internet option won't let me keep the pop-up ad on medium. It always defaults to accept all pop-ups and...
On Internet Explorer, on the Palm, or what?
The Palm is history. I mean, the Palm.
All right, so what are we talking about?
Yeah, we've got the cookie setting.
Are you talking about just a regular computer now?
Yes.
Internet Explorer?
Yeah, Internet options and your cookie setting where you set it to high, low, medium, accept all.
Yeah.
When I put it to medium, somehow it always defaults to accept all. When I shut it off, the pop-up ads always pop up. Email.
Are you running any type of... of other security software or anti-spyware programs that might be changing that back for you?
I'm not sure. I do have SpyBot. Would that do it?
SpyBot has some tools, depending on how you set it up, that might be locking your browser settings down. So you have to run SpyBot Search and Destroy they have two modes. They have basic mode and then full mode. And the full mode has some options in there where... It locks your browser down.
Well, that's part of what it's doing there, but the problem is these pop-up ads keep popping up. Google will not respond.
The pop-up ads?
Yeah, pop-up ads.
Then you probably still have spyware on there that SpyBot Search and Destroy has not found.
It is. It's command service.
Yeah, so what I will point you to... I will point you to www.geekradio.com/spyware, where I list three tools that I recommend and some other things to try to combat spyware. AdAware is one good one. The Windows Defender is another good one. And I also talk at length in that article about using ad remove programs to search out how to remove various spyware infections. Sometimes you'll find them in the ad remove programs. And sometimes, as we've discussed here many, many nights, sometimes depending on how bad your infestation is, you sometimes just have to kind of just break down and reload your system. And I don't want to have that conversation twice, but it sounds like we might have that tonight.
Well, it only does it when I click on the blue E, but when I go through Yahoo, I don't have any problem.
Right. So, well, you have to identify what the spyware infestation is. So if it's got a name, if it's taking you to a specific site, if it's got something that it's called, you can start looking around and trying to find some removal instructions on that. But I would start by using some of the better tools that are out there. There's the AdAware by LavaSoft. You can get get that at LavaSoft USA. It's all outlined on at geekradio.com/spyware. Some good tools out there. Also talks about looking in your ad remove programs for stuff that you don't recognize or doesn't. And you can may have to Google search them to find out what they all are. Some will be obvious, some won't, but it'll help you track down what you've got on your system and help you hopefully be able to remove it.
What about House Call? Are you familiar with that one?
Nope. Is it a spyware infection or is it an anti-spyware tool?
To clean up the stuff.
Like I said, I have the tools that I have not heard of that one. I don't. Okay. There are a lot of fake anti-spyware tools out there.
That's
there
a real one. That's trendmicrobes.com.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay. That's Jehovah just blurting out information. So you've heard of that program?
Yeah, that Trend Micro does that one.
Okay, pull that microphone a little closer.
All right, that's the Trend Micro product. That's you go to antivirus.com, and it's a free online scanner, and you just...
Okay. Well, I mean, granted, there are some other good tools out there. I have not had any experience with that one necessarily, but good to know that it might be good.
Okay.
If you want to try that out, certainly feel free. But I would recommend at least doing an initial scan using the tools that I outlined to see what you come up with and then go from there. All right? Thanks
Will
for
do.
Your call.
All right.
All right. All right. So now it is a little bit past the top of the hour, and we need to take some time to do the Barrett time, and hopefully I can do this right. No, that's not right.
It's the
technology. Why does it say track three? Okay. I get it because I know why it does that now. Because... Track one was the intro, track two was the news, and this is Barrett Time.
Hey, Barrett, what's happening?
I don't know.
Yeah, lights.
Well, zoom around town.
We interrupt this skit to bring you
Barrett Time! Barrett Time! Barrett Time!
There.
Yeah. That means it's time for
Barrett Time!
Anyway, take it away, Barrett.
All right. Lists abound. You can hardly surf Slashdot without spying yet another list that the moderators have seen fit to post on the main page. On the tales of the new seven wonders of the world is CIO.com's take on the seven wonders of the IT world. To make things slightly more interesting, I'll give you a little background on each one before divulging the actual entity. The first selection is a webcam, a Star.net Cam XL, that runs each year between April and October before it sinks into its freezing death. Its exact position changes each year, depending on ice flows. The project is sponsored by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and we're shut off from Jay in the studio, so we're just going to have to go this alone. The thing I'm talking about would, of course, be the computer closest to the North Pole, which is webcam number one. And the next one, a little further away from home, this computer runs on about 300 watts, the amount of power needed to bring for a light bulb, which is provided by a radioisotope thermoelectric generator. Guesses on this one? No. Okay, this would be the computer farthest from the Earth, which makes it a little bit easier. This would be NASA's Voyager 1 satellite. The next up, called Project 02 by the locals. Its backbone is provided by a fiber optic artery looped through the surrounding wilderness. Shrouded in secrecy, we do know that it houses roughly 200 petabytes on a 30-acre campus. This would, of course, be the, quote, world's most intriguing data center, unquote, Google. I'm not going to give any clues on the next one because it's fairly obscure. Launched September 2006 for use by scientists around the world, this world's largest scientific grid computing project called the eScience 2, made up of made the top seven wonders list. The next item is powered by 65,536 dual processor computer nodes. Its power requirements are a little bit larger, 1.5 megawatts, which is the equivalent of a 2,000 horsepower diesel engine. And here's the giveaway. Its clock speed is rated fastest in the world at over 280 trillion operations per second. The answer, that would be the world's fastest computer currently, is IBM BlueJean/L, or BGL. And two more. This PC checks in at 5.6 inches wide by 3.3 inches wide by 1 inch deep, and it runs Windows Vista. That's it. It's the smallest PC in the world capable of running Windows Vista. It's no Linux in a matchbox, but hey, they had to fit Microsoft in the list somehow. Microsoft, that is the OQO Model 02. And just to compare and contrast, the last one is titled The Biggest Paradigm Change in Enterprise Software. You have to remember that this is coming from CIO.com. This entry is made up of over 8.2 million lines of code, with that number growing an average of 85.63 lines of code per hour. Guesses? It's all on you, Dwight.
I have no idea.
Obscure. This would be the Linux kernel, so we end on open source score.
Yeah,
so that's it for wondering about it, and that's that for Barrett Time.
All right. Thanks for Barrett Time. And we got in the studio. We got Jehovah, Houston icon Jehovah, has dropped in unceremoniously and unannounced here at the studio. He is probably one of the most well-known, or at least longest-lived, sub-genii here in Houston, and probably
sub-genii.
So you know, KPFT is, has strong connections to the sub-genius community, and as always, it's esoteric to have Jehovah here in the studio. That's about all I got to say about that. Now, he has presented us with a quandary, because I don't know how to make this happen in the way that we're set up, because how many people are in the queue right now?
All but one line is used right now.
See, to try to do a call-in to give these tickets away, I've got two tickets to give away to the Reverend Horton Heat show, which is happening this Saturday at the Meridian. So I need to figure out what would be a way to give these away on the air, but we don't have an ability to... I wonder if they could call in on the 4,000 line. That would still work. So if Groovehouse needs to come in the studio and tell me if he can make this happen.
Or just give it away to the next lucky caller.
Maybe the next person calls it on line 3?
I think it's going to be a little tough. I want to find a way to give these things away. Let me think about this a little bit, but...
They're on night mode,
so we don't have a way to really easily do it. If anybody is with... If you want to come by the studio tonight in the next 50 minutes, and you want to go see the Reverend Horton Heat, you can come to the station, knock on the door, let us frisk you and make sure you're not armed, and we'll give you two tickets to the Reverend Horton Heat at the Meridian. That'll be the way we'll do it. Come if you're in the neighborhood. I know that there are people that listen to this that are out driving around. You got 50 minutes to come down to
419
Lovett Boulevard and grab these tickets. So we'll give them to you if you're in the neighborhood and you want to come by and get them. But that's going to be the Reverend Horton Heat at the Meridian on this, that's this Saturday. All right, so apparently we've got somebody on now. Did we get Pete? You still with us?
Yeah, I'm
apparently
here.
Groovehouse was concerned that there might be some phone problem, but it seems like that's not the case, so that's good. We have a caller calling in from Ohio.
We don't anymore.
We don't?
They dropped off, yeah.
Oh, rats. Well, if the Ohio caller was to call back, we will bump you up to the head of the queue. And next up, by length of hold, then, is going to be...
It's
going to
be Matt.
Matt, you're on the air.
Hey, good evening.
Good evening.
Okay, the deal quickly is that I am an old friend of the bass player of Reverend Horton Heat, and maybe we could talk later about that.
Jimbo.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, I know him.
Tim Wallace. Yeah, known him for 20 years. And haven't seen him for probably about 15. Would love to. But anyway, this is music related. I am an amateur musician, and I've got SoundForge and some other... My problem is that I want to send some, to me, some very short and simple music file to a friend, like a person in the military and overseas. Now, I just seem to have went from one ISP to another, from RR to...
Comcast?
Yeah. And I'm sending something, and what kills me is that I'm, like, for instance, an old song. Well, what they're telling me is that, okay, 15,728,640 bytes is what
15 megabyte file.
Too big for email.
Too big for email.
Pardon me?
Too big for email.
But, I'm compressing it, and I'm doing it by...
15 megs is 15 megs. It's too big. Now, if you want to transfer, if you want to send somebody a large file, there are a number of websites out there that will let you do this, called like sendfile.com, putfile.com.
Youcendit.com, mailbigfile.
Okay, you're blowing me away.
Actually, if you do Computer World, just like I read, let me see if I can find this, 3 or 4 days ago, put out an article on it, and they're talking about like getting, you know, files that are too big for email.
Yeah, let me blow you away, right? Too many references.
Well, I'm trying to listen. And,
okay, they're rather than sending the file via as an attachment to an email,
right?
There are a number of services that allow you to upload the file to their server.
Yeah.
And it's real easy. You go to the site, and they're free. They let you put a lot. So basically what you do is you go to the site, you follow the menus. It says, you upload the file.
Okay.
It puts the file on their site. And then when it's done, it gives you a link that you can then email to your friend. And that person can click on the link and then download the file.
Do they have to download software from that site?
No, it's all web-based. It's super easy. It's practically idiot-proof.
If you Google for large file transfer,
Google search for
large file transfer web, and there are a couple of articles.
Whoa, guys, I got my pen out.
Large file transfer. Just think about what you're doing.
Right.
And how
large file transfer
web.
And Google that.
Large file transfer web. Google that. You'll find links to sites like YouSendIt.com, PutFile.com. Any number.
And they're not going to ask me to download their stuff, so I don't have to worry about.
You don't have to worry about spyware. You don't have to worry about any of that. So if you go to putfile.com or usendit.com, those are two.
Usendit. I think I've heard of that.
Yeah, they're two very reputable sites. They'll let you do it. That's the easiest way to transfer a file like that, and they're free. And you don't have to clog up.
And
the
what
mail.
Does it? I mean, just briefly, if you can or if you care to or not, it's cool. I don't want to take up the time. But what is? How does that? Oh, right. Before we get in there, I must ask. I remember the old. Zip, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Zip.
What is this RAR stuff?
That's another form of compression that allows you to compress files.
Is it better than one or the other?
Some people swear by WinRAR, some people swear by, other forms of compression. They're all basically the same. It really depends on what you're trying to compress.
I'm using the free version, so I didn't know if there was
Doesn't matter.
I would say ZIP. The WinRAR stuff, that was really designed to convert binary files into something that's readable on text and then breaking it up into smaller chunks so you could put it on news servers. So that's kind of where that technology came out of. So I would just use ZIP to compress things.
But music files and image... Music files and image files don't compress that much anyway.
They're already compressed for the most part.
They're already compressed. So the only thing you're using any kind of archiving or ZIP tool for is to take multiple files and combine them into a single archive. So if I wanted to send you a bunch of images, I would maybe put those into a zip file just so I'd only have to send you one file.
Sure.
It wouldn't necessarily make the size any more manageable. I think you might gain a couple of K here or there, but overall it's not going to get the size down. But WinZip is the most universal. If you were to use WinRAR and send that to somebody, they'd have to download the WinRAR utility to open it up.
Yeah. Exactly. That's what I was thinking.
Brings us back to you not even sending it via email. And appreciate your call tonight. Thanks for
talking to somebody offline about Reverend. Is there any way?
Well, there's...
Call him down to the station real quick, Brian.
Man, I'm in the woodlands, dog.
Well, there's... I don't know what to tell you.
Maybe you could just talk to me offline.
All right, well...
Offline
you are.
Can we do like a little public service announcement? Because that's one thing that it irritates me both in the office and outside of it. Email's a great tool, but it was really only meant to send, text back and forth. Where, a large email back in the day would be 100K, and that's because you emailed someone like your dissertation. So attachments kind of came on the scene. And while it is an easy way just to click, attach this and send it to someone across the office, really, I would say like anything over a meg or 2 megs is kind of rude.
I agree with that, and I blogged about that, or I even wrote a column about that in one of my Houston Chronicle helpline columns where if people send that kind of stuff to me all the time, they'll drop a 5 meg file, they'll drop a 3 or 4 meg or even several 3 or 4 meg screenshots. They don't resize the images and they just drop those in my mailbox. Now, granted, there are those that will come back and say, well, now we're all on high speed and server space is so great. Still, regardless, maybe the bear holds up his PDA, holds up his cell phone. It is a pain sometimes to just get some type of giant file unceremoniously dropped in your inbox. And it really isn't meant to send large attachments, even though it can be done. And I agree with Barrett on that. That's what these sites are for.
So yeah, the best way to send links to it, like upload your pictures to Flickr and then send links to your galleries instead of actually sending all the pictures out to all 50 relatives. It's a better way to do it.
Yeah, and that, you know, it's a pet peeve of mine. And I sometimes get very frustrated when people just want to send me large files. And, you know, but that's very common. That's one of the problems we run into at the office I work at now is that we have a lot of marketing people and salespeople that like to send these gigunga PowerPoint presentations with all the audio files embedded and all of that stuff. And they send those around back and forth to other people on the same network for edits and modifications and send them back. And we have file shares in place, public shares where they can actually drop those files and they can just send people a link. And that's more education, I think, needs to happen with that. And that's why websites like PutFile and YouSendIt.com and so forth are so great, because it allows you to free up people's emails, because some people really don't like to get that stuff.
Now here's one dirty secret. Gmail doesn't cap their emails until 20 megabytes in size. So if you do want to store something, you can always email it to your Gmail account.
And you can sign up for additional Gmail accounts. So, yeah, that's a whole other story altogether. All right, who's up next by length of hold?
We've got Eric.
Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, Jay.
Hello.
And hello, the other Jay.
Hey.
Hey.
Yeah, I was about to undo everything you said and suggest Gmail allows 20 meg attachments.
Man, it's like old home week here at KPFT. I'm feeling old and at home.
Well, that's because you're bald.
And I'm not.
That's not the only reason I feel old, but we won't go into it.
Yeah, the other thing was I really appreciated the guy you had on there talking about the weather and NOAA and all that. I use NOAA exclusively. I don't bother with the commercial sites. Because for one thing, they've got wonderful satellite imagery where you can look at loop movies of anything from visual, infrared, and the best one is water vapor. Water vapor tells you everything that's going on almost.
Well, you're a bit more. I mean, my experience with NOAA is, I mean, it's a great site, absolutely, and it's definitely just puts the facts out there and lets you, you know, it's fair and balanced, as they say.
Well, there's no annoying commercials flashing at you and everything else.
And they're not trying to scare the bejesus out of you, you know, with trying to predict that a hurricane that's heading one place is heading another.
Well, the other thing to click on is, you know, they give all the public advisories. Click on the one that says discussion. Because then you get the meteorologists talking about it as they would between themselves versus this is a scary public advisory, you know, duck and cover.
Right. Well, cool.
Okay, my question is, I recently, you know, last week I had that problem with my, supposedly the power supply. It turned out that one of the RAM slots was shorting out, and no matter how much it worked for the geeks at the store, it would never work for me. So basically I had a new system built. Well, now the new system is not letting me do my Windows updates for XP. I've got the window up, you know, I even went to manual, configure, you know, go to the website and download it.
Right.
And after it installs or says it installs, it says some updates were not installed. Well, it's the entire list. Not some, it's all of them.
There is, what you can do is, there's a lot of websites that describe how to clear out the installer cache that Windows Update uses.
Yeah.
So sometimes something gets hung up in there, and so, like, for you might take the first one that's in the list and say, you know, put together a Google search and says, you know, KB blah 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 won't install. Or do you even do searches on the follow, you know, the term the following updates were not installed or whatever the exact phrase is that they use.
Yeah.
And you have to go in and they instruct you how to go into the temporary folders where those files are stored, where Windows keeps track of all of its updates.
Right.
And you kind of have to get in there and hack it away. Now, it's surprising that on a new computer that would not work.
Well, this is my home edition XP. It's a new computer, but since I needed all my data on my old drives, they just mapped everything over.
Oh, they just brought all the software back over.
Yeah.
So,
but it was working fine before. Why would it change?
Well, I mean, the point, I mean, when updates go bad, it's oftentimes a nightmare to try to get them working again, and I encounter this a lot. I had one where, I had one just the other week where the .NET framework update would not install on a computer, and I had to use some tools that I found. I had to basically use that specific update and Google search it not installing, and I found a page that described getting a .NET uninstaller to uninstall the original version that was already on there, go in and clean up these other files, and then run this manual install for the .NET framework. And after about six or seven reboots and following all these instructions, I finally got Windows Update to start working again.
Okay.
So you have to dig into it.
Well, I guess I could go to the site annoyances.org.
That helps. That's a good site.
Yep.
And like I said, just finding, you know, looking for sites that specifically talk about the updates. And you might see if you could go, like the updates that are listed when Windows Update runs, sometimes you can go to Microsoft's site and just get that specific update and download that file manually and then run the installer and see if it'll go on.
Well, that's what I did. I went to their download and I did it manually, and of course, they're giving me an installation summary. Successful, zero. Failed, 77. Remaining, zero.
Look.
And they give the whole list of all the ones, and it's like, well, if you're hanging up on one, skip it and go to the next one. But I guess Windows doesn't work that way.
Yeah, well, the thing is that the whole installer process is failing.
Yeah.
And it could have to do with, like I said, there are some files that control that. You have to start putting together searches. If you want to send me an email, you know, take a look at it, and you know, I'd send you some links that I know of that might help you out with it.
What's your email?
.NET is a typical culprit on that issue.
Right, and if you can get past the .NET framework install, sometimes that'll let the rest of the stuff install. But jay@geekradio.com, jay@geekradio.com.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
All right, Eric, thanks for your call.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Good luck. Thanks.
Bye.
All right, well, apparently we have a winner. Somebody has actually come to the studio and picked up the Reverend Horton Heat tickets. I don't know who it was, but Groovehouse is dealing with him now, giving him his tickets to go see the Reverend Horton Heat. That's a, you know, kind of a restrictive game we played there. You had to be within proximity, kind of a luck of the draw if you happen to either live down the road from the radio station or in a...
Or if you're stalking us.
Or if you're stalking us, if you're driving
that
by.
That pays off.
Yeah.
Sitting outside listening to the radio.
Or if you happen to live in the overturned dumpster down back in the alley over there back by Avondale or something, you know, come on by.
Kathy and Tom for the winners of the ticket, says
Kathy and Tom. Yay, Kathy and Tom. Whoever Kathy and Tom are. Did they both come, or was it just Tom? All right, it was a 9-second delay. We'll never know.
No.
All right, so we got calls in the queue, 713-526-5738. You have Jehovah, Kathy and Tom, to thank for that. He is the one that brought those tickets by. Who was the person at the Meridian who gave you the tickets and said give them more?
That was Donetta.
Donetta?
Donetta, she does all the booking over there.
Donetta. So, well, if she's listening, thanks to her and all the folks over at Meridian. You know, Reverend Horton Heat will be a great show. He actually, you know, just to kind of get off the computer subject for a minute and talk more about music. You know, for the last 15 years or so, a Reverend Horton Heat show was pretty much a Reverend Horton Heat show. And with the advent of the... I'm going back to computers now. With the advent of the internet and discussion groups and so forth, you know, a lot of people talk online about Reverend Horton Heat shows being, you know, kind of the same thing over and over again. The last time I heard that he was here, he actually talked to the audience and said, you know, I've been reading on the internet that everybody thinks my show's the same, so I'm going to just take requests. And I may not know the song, but we're going to just, you know... So he actually kind of did one of the first new Reverend Horton Heat shows that, you know, he didn't do the formulaic, you know, do the same songs that he always does every time he comes.
That speech is on YouTube. I just found it a couple days ago. Yeah, that's weird time space kind of hiccup there.
Wow. So it was here in the Houston that he...
Yeah, I want to say he did that in Houston. Yeah. So just
actually,
Google for...
He did it at every stop on the show.
And he took the same request.
He had the same shills in the audience calling out the songs. Right.
Well, a Houstoner got it on YouTube, so we'll claim credit for that.
Yeah. I've never seen the Reverend Horton Heat, so
that's
maybe
a great
I should
show.
Go. Maybe
it's a great
go.
Show. It's a great show. If you've never seen it, then certainly you won't be hurt by seeing...
Particularly since there's no smoking now in these venues.
That's true.
That would be
and
great.
And it's not real unless it's on the internet.
Everything on the internet is real, obviously. Just ask YouTube. All right, so we got calls in the queue. About a half hour left in the program tonight, so we're doing just fine in regards to time. The hurricane is obviously has not killed Flicky.
Not a hurricane.
Tropical storm. Tropical whatever it is. The weather.
Depression.
The weather disturbance.
It's a storm.
Afflicted is kind of like our canary, the miner's canary.
Uh-huh.
He's still okay.
He's a tropical depression.
I can still ping him. Yeah, he's good.
it's depressing me, I can tell you.
Well, I'm just so excited that I get to wake up in the morning and decide whether or not I'm going to go to work or not. Of course, working from home is all hinging on Roadrunner, or actually Comcast now, keeping my internet connection alive. Because my internet tends to go out when clouds form. These days, so it's kind of different.
Just when clouds form?
Yeah, just like when there's a threat of a storm, the cable modem light starts blinking, I think in fear, and then all of a sudden it'll start pouring down rain and it'll come back. Like, I don't get it. So anyway, who's up next by length of hold?
We've got Robin.
Robin, you're on the air.
Yeah, I got this Gateway laptop, and it's been a couple years since I got it, and all of a sudden every day I was getting the blue screens for everything, and I jumped through all kinds of hoops and couldn't make the blue screens go away. So I finally installed a clean copy of Windows XP, and I seem to have stopped the blue screen problem. But when I installed Windows XP, the Gateway has this recovery partition.
Yeah.
And, the recovery partition decided to become C drive.
Yeah.
And XP installed on D drive.
Okay.
And XP seems to be working perfectly, but I don't think I can live with my boot drive being D drive.
Well, the only way I know to be able to fix that problem would be to do a reinstall.
That's what I was afraid you were going to say.
Well, on the recovery partition, is the recovery data, the image still on the partition?
My gut feeling is the computer shipped with XP Media Edition.
Yeah.
And from work, I've got a copy of XP Pro.
Right.
Which is what I installed.
Okay, so you just ignored the recovery software altogether.
Right.
And installed Windows XP Pro on the computer. So the thing is that now it's an HP. Is it an HP?
Gateway.
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 Do you want to ever go back to that original software install, or are you content with just having...
My gut feeling is no.
All right. What I would consider doing then is blowing away the recovery partition and then reinstalling blow away everything. Knock out the partition, set it all up as one drive.
That's what you're going
to tell me. And then install... it's up to you. If you can live with the fact that your boot drive or your root drive is D... it's not the end of the world.
The other thing you could do,
I ran Partition Magic, and it's showing that the C drive, which is the recovery partition, is the active partition, so that I'm booting to an extended partition.
Yeah. Well, despite your gut feeling, what I think you should do is use what's in the recovery partition, which will set it up just the way you brought it home. The same thing pretty much as setting up as installing XP Pro, but it knows what partition is supposed to be which. And if you try to do, something that may be a little bit beyond you technically, the recovery partition software is going to be the simplest thing for you to do.
That's if you can make,
if it still works.
If you can use the
I don't think it's going to work because the XP Pro doesn't have a program to access the recovery partition.
Does Gateway offer you an option to access that recovery partition before you actually boot the,
only if I send them $20 for a new set of discs.
Well, I know that like on my HP that it at the beginning when it first starts up, I could hit like F2 to go or F10 to go into setup, and then F12 to run the recovery or go into the recovery partition, and would let me actually restore it that way. I don't know if Gateway has the same thing, but that might be a thing to consider, or just live with the fact that your stuff is on the extended partition if it's working.
Or else reformat the drive and reinstall.
Right.
Yeah, if you do that when you start up the installation routine for Windows XP, you'll have an option in there where you can go in and blow away that partition, so you have to watch for that when you start it up.
Either that or use partition magic and boot it from a...
Yes,
you use partition magic and just wipe out, you know, just
wipe
get rid
out
of everything.
Wipe out everything and then boot from the Windows XP.
Yeah, that would certainly do it. That would certainly
Can I ask a political question?
You can ask a political question. You might not get a political answer, but go ahead.
Okay. And I don't agree with Emperor George with anything he's doing.
Okay.
But all the commotions about his electronics eavesdropping and everything, is the whole world forgotten about Echelon?
No.
Or does nobody but me know about it?
No, not everybody has forgotten, and you're not the only one who knows about it. So, what's your point?
Well, with Echelon out there, what good is his eavesdropping program to him? He can do it with Echelon.
Well, Echelon's old. I think they're up to lamppost now. Honestly.
Yeah, they don't use Echelon anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Carnivore and lamppost are the... I guess Carnivore's even kind of old.
Yeah.
But if now they know that you know about it, so I would get out of the house now.
We've probably said too much. All right, 713-526-5738 is the number to call if you'd like to be on the air. We've got plenty of open lines. Flick did.
I downloaded him.
You did?
Yeah.
He kept pinging him and then finally
That's
downloaded
That's a huge him. Attachment.
I got it through Gmail.
or so how was your... Let me see if I got a microphone for you. I do. There you go.
Excitement? Yeah, not really.
I mean, you sounded like you were pretty, you know, anxious to, you know, take your... Flick had called me, you know, maybe 2 hours before showtime and asked if I knew if anybody else was going to cancel, which I knew where this is going. But I didn't really know that he was... I thought he was going to call in scared. Like Jennifer, the intern, called in scared. She's not coming to the show because she didn't want to get trapped in any rain. I thought... Afflicted might be telling me, you know, weather being what it is, I don't know if I want to mess with it, I'm just going to stay home. But no, he wants to drive to Galveston, and I don't know why. You're not a surfer.
No, I just thought it was, there were surfers down there. I thought it would be interesting.
Yeah,
it wasn't really all that interesting. But, you know, I went with a coworker. It was one of those kind of spur-of-the-moment things. And the coworker drives in, you know, a small RX-8, so that added to the risk factor because it's really low to the ground vehicle.
Flood prone.
But we did take a camera with us, a video camera with us, and
I got a YouTube.
A lot of hard hitting investigative journalism went into our commentary. It's.
I can't wait to see it. I'm gonna have to put that up on the Geek Radio site.
And like I said, there was a casualty. It was my new shoes.
Did you just step off into the surf?
Well, you know, we stopped at one point, and we were gonna go out on one of the boardwalks, like out over the waves, kind of. Closer to Freeport than Galveston, but there was a large puddle of water, and I was like, I'll just jump through this puddle of water, except the puddle kept continuing for about 40 feet and got deeper, so yeah, my shoes bit it.
You would think it's as even spur of the moment, you would have probably dropped by the house to get some more appropriate shoes.
Nope.
So
straight from work.
So was there any wind?
Oh yeah, there was some wind.
It certainly blew.
it was blowing consistently, maybe 20-25 miles an hour or something. I mean, it was okay.
Was there rain?
There was rain. It wasn't real heavy most of the time, but it was big enough at some points that it would kind of sting when it hit you. So I didn't actually leave the vehicle very much.
No sideways palm trees or anything like that.
No. There were some signs on the highway that were kind of like twisting in the wind, but I think it's just because the poles weren't very strong.
Did you see any wild-eyed TV broadcasters out there?
Yeah,
I saw
several.
All right.
I saw several TV vans. You know, they were all there near the landmark because there's actually lights that go out into the water so you can see the waves hitting stuff, that's where all the excitement was, so they could get their background shots to, you know, oh my God, people, hear it, you know, it's crazy. And then one of the bodyboard, you know, guys, like, walk by in the background, hey, dudes.
All right. Well, we got some calls in the queue, and we're going to keep moving through here. More hurricane updates as they develop. Tropical storm updates as they develop. More afflicted updates as they develop. More shoe updates as they develop.
They're in my car.
Are they salvageable?
I hope so.
All right. Who's up next by length of hold?
We've got George.
George.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
How y'all doing?
Good.
First and foremost, you guys, y'all can talk to me like I'm an idiot, because totally I am, because guess what? This is the first time doing any of this.
Okay.
What I actually got is, me and my wife, we bought this e-machine at first of the year, and I've had several people tell me by now it should have been updated a bunch of different things on it. I think we've put a bunch of stuff on it, because when it first boot up or we first turn it on, it's like forever by the time. And I heard you tell somebody earlier, after you use, you know, have so much going on for so long, it's trying to pull all that information in so you'll be able to access it as you need it.
Right.
Okay, now what I'm dealing with, about a month ago, we had a storm come through and I shut everything down. And after the storm passed, I kicked it back up. I can't get to, well, usually if I pull up a web page, it'll be there momentarily, and I might be in the middle of a weather feed or a live newscast or something, and it will say it goes and says something to the effect of, your service stopped working, either your browser stopped working, and it asks you, do you want to make this your default browser? And when I usually try to go to that, go back to administrator, it gives you a key to go back to administrator. We go through all of that. Okay, that happens for a little while. Then it goes back to that same mode where I can't even get my printer to go up on this, modem router deal here. It used to have activity all the time, no matter whether we were using it or not. It was always activity. Now only the first four lights are showing, and the only time you get some activity is when I hear the the brain or the main computer is in there running, doing this thing, and that's just for a couple of seconds. My question is, how do I go? Do I need to go back and purchase like that premium disc? I bought it from Walmart. Go buy the premium disc and reinstall everything and start all over.
Why did it not come with the ability to make recovery software for this thing?
The only thing they gave us was, and I just had one of those, you know, people that wear the blue vest there. She told me if it starts acting up to take that, it's only a 30, it's a Windows, Microsoft Windows Vista Home Basic 32-bit. She told me to reinstall that. That's if I got a disk to download my files and everything in there, so just in case I don't lose any.
Well, right. I mean, if you got any data on the computer that you care about, mail, pictures, music, that kind of stuff,
right,
you need to back that up before you take that other disk and reinstall the operating system.
Okay, but probably since we're really going in and really using it now, that might be my problem. It's probably just overloaded now.
Well, I mean, if you browse the web, if you're pretty new to this, you might have picked up some spyware, you might have picked up a virus, you might have picked up who knows what. It happens to everybody.
Okay, yeah, because we got, we bought and paid, I mean, almost $100 worth of, matter of fact, that spy stuff. We got, what's the company, McAfee? We got that, we got something, Firefox
is a browser.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
My wife purchased, I mean, that's like I said, over $100 worth of stuff and, you know, had put on here.
Uh-huh.
And most of it she got online. Now, is that probably one of the problems? Is it something that we probably should have bought a disc for?
Not necessarily. Well, let's say maybe we take a look at trying to recover, or, you know, don't go to the scorched earth way of dealing with it. Maybe we don't format everything and reinstall.
Right.
first thing I would suggest that you might do is, you know, you've got McAfee on there. That's good. That's an antivirus software. You want to make sure that that's up to date.
It is, because we just put that up. Matter of fact, when it started acting up, we redid everything last month.
Okay.
And like I say, after
had
that...
Had it been, pardon me, had it been finding anything or detecting anything?
No, like two or three times a day, it'll run it. You know, I run it. It runs its, the scan or whatever you want to call it. And it'll give that big loud ding and says everything is fine.
Everything's fine.
All the updates are up to date.
Okay.
Yeah.
No. Now, the McAfee is an antivirus tool. It's not an anti-spyware tool.
Unless he has McAfee Internet Security, which has spyware.
Yeah, we do have the Internet Security.
Okay, so is it...
But it's always showing at the bottom right where those little iconic things are at the bottom right hand of the screen. It's always... I'll pull it up, and it'll show everything is doing what it's supposed to do. The spyware, the virus.
Okay,
and,
good. So is it... And it hasn't been detecting anything? It hasn't come up and alerted you to any problems or anything?
None at all. And I try to stay on top of it.
All right.
We're up here in Huntsville, and, you know...
Oh, that sounds good. So your internet connection is DSL or cable or what?
It's probably DSL.
DSL, okay. So is the you've got the computer connected to the DSL modem directly?
Right.
And the DSL modem, obviously, that's where you're getting your internet from.
Yeah, I got that that big cable, USB cable or whatever you call
right.
it. Yeah, I got that hooked up. I went back through and double-checked everything. Had the phone guy come that came in, and he redid it and put the... only thing I had wrong was the one of the filters, instead of having it where it comes into the house, that he had me bring it up to right where my phone jack is going before it gets to my computer.
Okay. Are you noticing any poor... But you said the computer, when you start it up, is very slow to...
Very, very slow.
How much memory does it have?
I know this might make any sense, but my phone even rings different now. It's like a bring, and then it... A real short bring, and then it bring real long, and then it goes back to this... It's almost like, if I was crazy, I think it was a code, but it's just, it's weird. And I noticed that started happening last month also, and that's why we thought... Maybe it was, we called a phone company out, and he said everything was, you know, wired up and checked and right, but so I probably need to check with my, what they call it, provider or whoever, the people, I guess, we're getting off stuff through SBC or AT&T, I guess it's all the same folks now, everybody bought everybody else's.
How much memory does this computer have?
Oh my goodness. I tell you, you're going to talk to me like an idiot.
The reason I ask is you're running Windows Vista. You bought it at Walmart.
Right, right.
It's a low-cost computer.
Very low.
Yeah,
it was
the $400 one.
All right. It probably has only five... I bet it only has 512 megabytes of memory.
Which is very little.
Which is not enough to run Windows Vista. That's like the minimum on the box
is
to run Windows Vista.
Is the computer in front of you right now?
I'm sitting in front of it now. I've got the control panel printer page up right now.
What's the quickest way in Vista to determine...
Click on this little start button down in the corner.
Okay, so start everything. I'll go back to start.
No, click on the start button.
I'm
down
on
at
it.
The bottom, and then on right click, use your mouse and right click on the word computer on the start menu.
Okay, right click, and it got open, and explore, search, manage.
Properties. Click on properties.
Okay, got it.
And that'll tell you, that general menu right there will tell you how much memory the computer has.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's see, manufacturer, rating, model, processor, memory,
how much
502
is?
MB.
Yeah, so yeah. You basically have a half a gig of RAM. I tell you, I'm running Vista on a 1 gig system, and it can be painfully slow to start up sometimes.
That's your issue.
So very possible, I just don't have enough memory.
Right.
So because you've added on things like the antivirus software, if you've loaded up other things, the internet
security. Does those games count?
They do, but not necessarily when you're booting.
Okay.
But the other stuff that you've loaded that loads up any kind of helper applications when the computer boots, that's going to slow it down. More memory would certainly not hurt you.
Okay.
And it's a relatively low-cost investment these days. I saw Fry's was offering...
that's my place there. Boy.
They were offering a good deal on some RAM. Like, I think it was with rebate for 2 gigs. It was like 58. $60.
Sounds good, because we were planning on making a trip. We're up, like I said, we're up in Huntsville, so we have to travel back to Houston.
I would, you know, either plan to take the computer with you, or if you got the model number, if that's where you got it from, just tell them that, you know, you want to take this thing, you want to upgrade the memory, and go at least to a gig, but Dwight said it once, and I believe it's true, 2 gig is the new 1 gig.
Right.
If you're using Vista, if you have 2 gigs of RAM, you'll just see such good performance.
Yeah. Also, you notice he said he had 502 megabytes.
Which right. means it's allocating some memory for video.
For video. So you actually have less than 512. Right. So okay. you should definitely upgrade your memory. That would fix a lot of your problems.
Yeah, because right. I was trying to get, I kept, when I finally realized what this rating thing was about, I noticed the rating was 2.0, which means it's kind of on the low end, and they say you should average either 3.0 or better.
Right. Well, that could be because of the low amount of RAM that you have.
Okay.
So the rating is based on your system specs in terms of processor, hard drive space, and memory.
And that number will always be the lowest item on the list.
So if it will?
Yeah.
So it might be that because of the 512, that brings the overall score down.
And the memory speed is important, too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, guys, believe it or not, y'all got me in the head, because I kept figuring, you know, I even went back and when I called the people at the phone people, the dude with it, I actually got the service through, and the lady was walking me through everything just like you guys did, and she said that very possibly because of the changes that were made prior, I would have to go back, and she said something about a setting that would put my printer on several different ports, wherever I have an open port at, it'll be able to pick up the information and still give me a printout. If that makes any sense.
I've got to say, it really didn't. But
she might have been just trying to get me off the phone. But like I said, I probably sounded totally throwed off because I was trying. Like I said, this is all new to me, so I'm...
Yeah.
Well, if you had Windows XP and you had 512, you probably get away with it. On Vista, you cannot.
Okay, so...
Right. And that's not to say that, you know, you don't want to... I mean, there's still maybe other underlying issues, but certainly, you know, anything that kind of bottlenecks the system and starts to bring it down, more right. memory will give it. I mean, it sounds to me, based on our previous discussion, that if you're not detecting anything, if McAfee is not my only solution when it comes to preventing spyware and viruses, but
is there a company out there
let me finish my point here.
Uh-huh.
If it's not detecting anything, then chances are you don't have anything.
Okay.
What I have found in my experience is that, you know, when something starts to detect something, it means you've got a problem, but it won't necessarily clean it all. So like
right.
McAfee might detect something and clean it, but not get rid of everything. But the fact that nothing is turning up, if you wanted to go to the Geek Radio site, go to geekradio.com/spyware, and or just go to LavaSoft USA and get Adaware, which is a really good spyware tool.
Is that Java, JAVA? Or Lava?
Lava.
Lava,
LAVA. Okay.
LavaSoftUSA.com. There's a program called Adaware. It's free. It's a great anti-spyware tool. It's a spyware scanning tool. Basically, install it, run the updates, and let it check your system.
Okay.
It might find something that McAfee hasn't, but it sounds to me like you've probably just loaded up a lot of applications. You probably filled up your hard drive a little bit.
Okay,
and
yeah.
You might just need to give that computer a little bit more breathing room. Even if the problem ends up being something else, you will not suffer or ever regret having more memory
okay.
on this computer, because your games are going to run better. Even if there's still some other underlying problem, you'll get to that, but when it is running properly,
I'll be able to find out what's wrong.
Hopefully so.
Okay, yeah, when you said Lava, because my wife, she put something on here the other day called Java something. I thought that was...
Well, the Java is a software used to render certain websites and certain animations and things like that. So Java is normal, but...
Okay.
And then, you know, also be aware that you don't want to just install everything just because it's there.
Because it's there. Well, that's right. What I've been trying to tell her. She said, this is good. We won't need this. Well, not necessarily.
Right. And there's a lot of people out there trying to get you to install stuff that's not so good, too.
Yeah. So yeah, we definitely every so often get those whatever they call it. I've been blocking. I put the block on. I don't even want to see that crap. Okay, guys. I appreciate it. And, hey, y'all got a good service. I listen to you guys every Wednesday, and I appreciate y'all very much.
No problem. Thank you so much, John.
Uh-huh.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
All right. We got plenty of open lines because I don't think this next call is going to take very long, but we got about 9 minutes left in the show, so we got time maybe to take a couple of more calls or just hang out with J-Hova, whatever happens here. But 713-526-5738. Up next, it's Steve.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Steve.
Yes, my problem tonight, Jay, is I cannot access geekradio.com. This problem started about 3 weeks ago, approximately. That's when I first became aware of it. I haven't changed anything on any of my PCs.
What happens when you try to access it? Steve?
Oh. Did he fall off?
No, he went back, he went on to hold for some reason. Steve, sorry about that.
Okay.
So what happens when you try to access geekradio.com?
I get a sign that comes up, says the page cannot be displayed. And so here's what I've done. I know we're short of time.
That's all right.
I have two desktops and a laptop and a network here at my house. I tried all of my three computers by taking the yellow card out of the modem and going straight into my computers and tried accessing Geek Radio that way. All three of them do the same thing.
They can all get to other websites?
Sir?
They can all get to other websites?
Yes. I have no trouble going anywhere else in the world. And this trouble started about 3 weeks ago. That's when I was first aware of it. And so I tried a dial-up. And if I hook a dial-up to any of my three computers, I can access Geek Radio.
Who's your ISP?
It's Embark. Well, I guess that's the telephone company. Earthlink is
Earthlink.
The one that has my...
You're not in front of a computer now, are you?
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm. And I can ping it, and I can do a trace route, and I go to you guys. I go to y'all's site.
Have you tried downloading, like, another browser, like Firefox?
Yes, I've tried Firefox and Mozilla, and same thing. And
are you running any type of internet security or firewall program?
The phone company guy had me disable all of that.
What firewall are you using?
I was using the security suite that Microsoft gives us. It's the Microsoft firewall.
Okay,
I
so it's a built-in firewall to
And I'm running, at this time, I'm running no virus, no antivirus, no firewall. I'm hooked straight up through my router and into a modem.
But you said you could ping us, so you'd actually type in pinggeekradio.com and stuff would come back?
That's right. I could type it in www.geekradio.com. I could type in the IP address, the 209, whatever. I don't have it out in front of me. 209.
Yeah, 624557. Yeah, that's
right.
That's it.
I can trace route. I can ping it. And so could the Embark telephone guy. But neither he couldn't get into Geek Radio. And when I trace route,
you
I go through
to
about 10.
He could not get to it either. Was he at your house when he tried, or
no,
somewhere else?
He got in on the port.
But he could not access the website himself.
No, not with it. But he could ping and do everything I could do.
Right. So he has the same problem you have.
Well, he seems to think since we could ping and trace route it, that there is something that for some reason or other, telephone companies not be allowed to access y'all servers somewhere. That's what he said, and I said, should I tell him that? And he said, yes.
They don't like us. They do not like us very much.
Well, I'm beginning to think some like that along the lines. Now, I can access KPFT.
Can you access my blog at baldheretic.com? Because it's on the same server.
Okay, I haven't tried that.
Try
baldheretic.
B-A-L-D.
Okay, let me type it in real quick.
Sure.
Here. That's with a www?
Yeah, with a www. Dot B-A-L-D's
H-E-R-E-T-I-C.
That is correct, .com.
.com. Okay. I got a Goga.
A what?
AGOGA.com. My gosh.
It's not your site.
Let me go. I know I'm looking at it. I typed in www. There it is. www. Bald Heretic. I spelled it BaldHeretic.
That's cool.
Oh, and I left the O out.
Of com?
Yeah.
CM? What country code?
Oh, I don't know where I went.
I don't know where you went either.
Just a minute.
All right.
Yep. Yeah, if you type in .cm, you bounce automatically to a goga.com.
Yeah. I'm having a trouble getting that thing back without it trying to go somewhere.
Close your browser down and fire it up again. If you could do this real quick, we've only got a few minutes left, so I want to see where
okay.
we did.
All right, I'm coming back. got my browser up.
www.baldheretic.com. That is my personal blog where I post all my photographs. I'm just occupying airspace until our...
We're not going to get to it.
Okay, here I go. I got it in there right this time.
What do we got?
Okay, I'm sitting there. It's chewing on it. And it's going nowhere.
It's a nice new lens you've got, though.
Do you know what your IP address is?
Can
you tell it to me?
My IP address. I don't have it handy, though, Jay.
Oh, you can IP config it.
Oh, okay.
What about your username and password?
If you could real quick tell me what your IP address is.
Okay.
Run CMD.
Okay, the IP address is 192.
Yeah, it's going to be a private. Why don't you go to what is my IP address or what is my IP.com?
You're on a router. Sorry if didn't think about that.
I've got it up here.
What is it?
This is the first one on the trace route.
Yeah.
67.76.192.1.
I can ping him. I can ping that. Although that .1 sounds like a gateway to me.
All right. Well, I'm just checking my access to make sure it wasn't blocked. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. We're not going to be able to do too much troubleshooting here. No, you say you have tried plugging the modem directly in. He had the same problem. So I'm thinking maybe that your ISP is having some issues with routing to our site.
Okay. Earthlink.
Email me. I don't know if it'll... I guess I'll let you email. Email me, jay@geekradio.com. And we'll start up an email dialogue, and we'll see if we can sort it out, okay?
Okay, I'll do it on dial-up. Thanks, Jay.
All right, thank you.
Night-night.
All right. Well, we are out of time, unfortunately. I apologize to Chris and Nick, who did not make it onto the air with us tonight. And that's the wrong one, I guess. Afflicted is like the guy, man. That's just, you know, he can run this board. There we go. All right. You've been listening to Technology Bites here on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Plickton.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
And thanks, Jehovah, for dropping in on us. We will see you next Wednesday night for more Technology Bites. Stay dry. Coming up next is Border Crossings at 10 o'clock here on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.